It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome on in. This is the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast. Today we are breaking down some later round prospects in this year's upcoming draft that could help you out on your fantasy teams. For this year, we're also going to do a little free agency cleanup and talk a little bit about what exactly the Chargers are doing. Loaded show. Let's start it up. Welcome on in. This is the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast. Really, the epicenter of the sporting world today is this show, Mario. I mean, sure, you could mention that March Madness is going on or that Major League Baseball got started yesterday morning, at least by American time standards, and officially fires up next week. But no, it's all about this pod right now. I'm excited.
Yeah, we got the day three types that all your redraft league mates are going to be spending, you know, 70% of their fab on when they shouldn't. But you'll know who these guys. You'll know it's some bum, not one of the, like, the good guys that we point out here.
Yep, you'll be the one laughing as everyone is scrambling to the waiver wire to pick up the guy that you drafted with your last pick.
Although, or yeah, the Nacua example from you. It's like you'll be getting the Nacua of this year from this podcast, and you'll not be chasing the stupid fab pickup in, you know, week five that everybody forgets about by week six.
See, precisely. So yeah, we're not going to lead you down the Amari DiMercato path, and we're gonna try to be a little bit more helpful. And for those watching, listening live, I do have my FAU Owls shirt on, so hoot hoot. This weekend,
you got a lot of teams, man. You got like nine.
I do. I absorb them I don't know. I'm not a Marvel guy, so I don't want to say Infinity Stones.
Kirby.
Yeah, I like Kirby. My girlfriend is an FAU graduate, so you know.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
And they made the Final Four last year. It was very, very exciting. They play Northwestern. You know, bite the hand that feeds me a little bit. I know that the brass is a lot of Northwestern grads, but yeah, hoot hoot, y'all. Let's go Owls. But all right, Mario, let's start things off with a little free agent cleanup. Things obviously were starting to slow down just a little bit when we talked last. So we got all the big major developments from the initial wave of free agency. But there was a trade on Thursday night, so just a few hours after we recorded, Keenan Allen going over to the Bears for, I believe, a fourth round pick. What was your reaction to that? Because in my mind, having a guy that's still catching over 70% of his targets with extremely high volume, obviously you have the injury and durability concerns. And yes, Keenan Allen is getting up there in age, but for a fourth rounder, I think that's a really nice addition to that Bears offense.
Yeah, so the price was the fourth round pick in part because of Allen's age, but also because they're going to be paying him quite a bit of money. He's on that 4-year, $80 million deal. So he's going to turn 32 in a little over a month. He's had actually the best injury luck of his career overall the past 7 years. His first 4 years in the NFL, there was a recurring narrative that just got louder and louder each year about, like, oh, he's made of glass. He's never going to stay healthy. And that followed a kind of concerning saga with his PCL at California. So there was the look that he was going to be kind of like damaged goods or an injury liability. And that actually is reversed in almost entirely the past, even with that, you know, hamstring thing, that the nagging hamstring thing, it was a groin, whatever it was. That to me was more just kind of like a bad luck, you know, the kind of injury that can happen to anyone. And then the aggravation was just because Brandon Staley is a negligent coach and got his players hurt repeatedly by just not doing the sensible thing. So I'm not going to hold that against Allen. However, when you reach an age point like he's at, you know, your durability luck is going to get worse no matter what. And I think it's safe to say the peak has passed with Allen, but now we wait to see kind of, as we saw with Adam Thielen and with the Panthers last year, it's like a guy can lose a step, clearly lose a step and like sort of lose an aspect of his game. And in Thielen's case, it was, you know, he can't run on the boundary anymore, but he was still good enough in the slot to have a really big year last year. And Allen has primarily been a slot guy for his whole career, but he's also been viable outside. It's just, I think in the next year or two, he might need to sort of trend toward the slot even more and trend, you know, shallower depths, because he was also a guy who was running like a 4.6 coming out of college. And if he's running a 4.7 by, you know, next April, then the Bears necessarily got to keep his depth of target probably around like, you know, 7.5 yards, 8 yards or less. So we'll see what, if he does decline, he's been good enough lately that Allen could still be, you know, not a wide receiver one for the Bears or for fantasy, but good enough for the Bears offense to sort of, you know, have identified and secured for an affordable enough price, the kind of next step in the, you know, the building process that they're trying to work towards. So I think it was a good pickup by Ryan Poles. It's just also like, it's one of those things, you need to make a trade for a guy like Keenan Allen when you have all the idle assets that the Bears have. It's at once a productive move, but also sort of the bare minimum, or just sort of the most obvious thing, basically. They also had to get their salary floor a little bit higher in adding Allen's contract as that. So better than any free agent pickup maybe that they could have made at receiver and for, you know, for as many draft picks as they have, as much salary cap as they had. It was kind of a trivial expense.
Yeah, so it made all the sense in the world for the Bears to do it. The sort of prevailing narrative, which I you know, I can certainly get behind when it comes to this, is, you know, assuming that they take Caleb Williams first overall, which obviously seems even more likely net now with Fields in Pittsburgh. You give Williams a you know, kind of supporting cast core of DJ Moore, who's still in his prime, Keenan Allen, who can just be that underneath security blanket, and Cole Kmet, who I still think is a very solid tight end. Yeah. Maybe not like top five or anything, but definitely, you know, I would say he's a top 10 tight end. And I think he's got some legit skills to him. Maybe we haven't even seen his best ball just yet. So that's a nice group to work with. Like, does this, if they run into this upcoming season with the initial loadout of Moore and Keenan Allen and two wide, Cole Kmet, like, do you have some interest then in Caleb Williams in redraft where he's going?
Maybe. I think Williams is good. He's not, to me, like a Trevor Lawrence caliber prospect, but better than Fields, better than Lance, you know, kind of player who has the profile of maybe not likely NFL success, but about as likely as you can get with a prospect. And certainly quarterback prospect success can be, you know, the odds can be made better by giving them a really nice landing spot, which, as the Bears are currently constructed, they have a much, much better infrastructure than most first overall pick teams. Most teams picking a player like Caleb Williams would be sending him to a much worse situation. And maybe with the, you know, DJ Moore, Keenan Allen, Cole Kmet, three leading targets, that's a strong enough group for, I don't know, if Williams makes the Pro Bowl this year, that should not surprise anyone, you know, especially this in this era where Tyler Huntley can make it, Williams definitely can.
The images of Mac Jones doing the gritty after his rookie year in the Pro Bowl dance across my head. I do forecast a better career for Williams than I did with Mac Jones. And then with this trade, just digging into the Bears a little bit further before we get to a couple other items here. When it comes to them adding Keenan Allen, you know, the popular mock draft intelligentsia has posited that they go Williams first, and then they take whichever receiver is available at 9. Do you think that changes now? Because they don't have a ton of draft picks necessarily. So moving off of 9, could be another pragmatic move for the Bears. I mean, they just have all this, like, you know, flexibility that other teams just simply don't have. So that, you know, they already have their franchise quarterback locked up with that first pick. You can move back into the teens or the 20s, depending on the offer, and still probably end up with a good receiver. So your strategy doesn't change too much. You just get a slightly different caliber of prospect if you move off of 9.
Yeah, that's something they'll probably look at. They might want to try to get back the second rounder that they traded for Montez Sweat. But yeah, I don't know if there will be someone there for a buyer to offer something worth their time. We'll see. I think there's a pretty good chance that the Bears just stay at 9, take someone like Adonai Mitchell, both because he's young and because he's like an upside guy to kind of have the long term theoretical payoff that would justify otherwise giving him a pretty light workload as a rookie, presumably behind Moore and Keenan Allen. But as a wide receiver 3, that would be an upgrade, obviously. And it's nice to have a player with Mitchell's, conventional 3-down trait profile. Even if he's a prospect, even if he's sort of redshirting his first year, it's nice to have a player like that step onto the field. If a player like Keenan Allen were to miss any time, it's better to go to a guy who's supposed to start eventually in that case than a guy or a committee of guys who are always going to be backups, in my opinion. So Mitchell, I think, makes sense at 9. I'm assuming that Odunze, Neighbors, and Harrison are all gone by that point, is why I'm just going straight to Mitchell. And I'm also assuming Mitchell's going to go ahead of Brian Thomas, which is why I'm not assuming Brian Thomas there. But if they do move back, I guess it would be like teams trading up for maybe corner or offensive tackle. That might be the kind of positions we see going in that range of 9 to 20 or so. But yeah, I don't think there'd be anything wrong with taking Mitchell at 9, even though I think it'd be kind of a reach, I guess. But it's a kind of player that they could use. You know, Allen's going to be 32. Nothing wrong with having a high upside, high first round pick as a wide receiver 3. That's what the Vikings were doing with Randy Moss. It's right. An extreme case. It's not going to bear out that way, but it's not unprecedented for a receiver pick, even if it's a Mitchell type, to pay off for the Bears there. But they might have options. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I think you make a good point about them staying at 9, because I think, it's a logical case as to why they would trade back, but it does ultimately take 2 to tango. And, I think that, teams like the Broncos and the Vikings are probably going to be aiming a little bit higher if they do try to move up into the top 10. Like, it's probably not going to be for 9. It's probably going to be like the Titans pick or the Chargers pick. So speaking of the Chargers, obviously let go of Mike Williams. He has since been picked up by the New York Jets. So your thoughts on his fit within the New York offense, and then what we'll finally get to, what exactly the Chargers are up to with this new regime.
Yeah, I thought that was a good signing for the Jets. It's not an exciting one exactly. Williams is a little older than I thought. I'm trying to load his player page here. He's going to be turning 30 in October, returning from an ACL. I don't even remember all the other stuff. I know that the neck injury was kind of the spinal injury was originally the concern with Williams coming out of Clemson. Yeah, it seems safe to say that stuff's in the rear view, but he's found other ways to miss time even before you get to an injury as serious as the ACL. So it's I guess you would call it like a boom or bust kind of acquisition, but one that's justifiable and reasonable whichever way it turns out. It's like if Williams kind of burns out this year because of the knee or some new thing, or if it's because he loses a little bit of a step and he was too slow to afford losing a step, that stuff is all possible, I think, as he enters this stretch of his career. But he was playing at a high level last year, and more importantly, as far as the Jets were to see it, it's like they had no wide receiver 2. Maybe Lazard does better this year, I don't know. But after Garrett Wilson, they just had nobody at receiver who could line up outside. And Williams is a pretty convenient signing for them, really, because it's low stakes, low cost. And if Williams does come through, it's a pretty substantial you know, it's a substantial asset for them because they're in this win now mode. And as far as winning this year goes, you know, getting a average or better wide receiver two at $6.5 million for 1 year is pretty, you know, it sets up neatly for the Jets basically.
Yeah. The Jets are there might be more like single season pressure on them than anyone else in the league.
Oh, yeah.
Like the window is Joe slamming Douglas. Shut. Like you gotta be limboing.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but what they've done this offseason, I think has been solid to say the least. I mean, you grab Tyron Smith, you grab 40% of the Ravens offensive line from last year. Again, you pick up Mike Williams, you have Garrett Wilson. You're assuming that Rodgers can be, you know, some respectable percentage of his former self in Green Bay. And, you know, all of a sudden that plus Breece Hall, like you're looking pretty good. I think the Williams addition kind of puts a little bit less pressure on them to hunt for a receiver in the first round. They also have less of a pressing need to fix the offensive line through the draft. Although, you know, they could certainly still use some help there, but maybe it changes their first round plans overall. But I think that the Williams signing, yeah, to your point, the depth chart was looking particularly dire prior to that signing, once you got past Garrett Wilson. But on the point of the Chargers, so they hire Harbaugh, they bring in Greg Roman, show favorite, and yes, they've had to change a lot. The Chargers are going to look so different in September. It's going to be like really almost disorienting to see them come out of the huddle in week one, because gone are Austin Ekeler, Mike Williams, Keenan Allen, and I guess Gerald Everett too, although he yes, probably doesn't stick in people's
also a
dreams
show favorite
the same. Yeah. Yes, big time. Yeah, for Will Dissly and Hayden Hurst, you know, you got to make those upgrades where you can. But
I do like Dissly, but yeah, that Hurst one sucks. That guy doesn't do anything. It's
like
clear.
Roman knows like better than anybody, but
I guess as a backup, it's kind of a who cares sort of thing. But yeah, that I also will always probably have like a irrational kind of axe to grind against the Hayden Hurst brand because of him being picked ahead of Lamar Jackson and Mark Andrews in the same draft. It's just hard to get over some things. That's one of them for me. But yeah, so the vision though is clear enough what the Chargers are doing. They already ran a lot of 2 and 3 tight end stuff the entirety of the Staley reign, and also including the year with Kellen Moore. So in terms of like big personnel, it's not terribly new if the Chargers were to run a lot of looks with whatever Dissly and Hurst and maybe someone else that they add from this point. But what's different is the Chargers would previously under Staley, under Moore, would do a lot of, you know, 3 tight end, 2 tight end stuff. And then they do spread formations and they throw from it, or when they would run between the tackles, it'd be Josh Kelly. Just not serious, not even the slightest seriousness in any of their attempts to establish a ground game. Whereas, of course, now the Chargers under Greg Roman, they might run the same number of 2 tight end, 3 tight end stuff, but it's going to be narrower splits where they're lined up. You're going to see I formations. You're going to see Gus Edwards, who can actually run the ball between the tackles specifically. So you can tell that whereas Brandon Staley, it's almost like he deprioritized the run game and the run personnel in the sense that he thought it would be bad if they were good at it. You know, it was like Staley was like, oh no, that might be good for running the ball. And that's not knowing math. That's not being good at analytics. If you do something that might be productive, if it's running, you gotta throw the ball. And to the extent that you run, you have to kind of like starve the infrastructure. You have to almost like make it bad so that you're not tempted into calling a run play, you know, like it's almost like Staley was afraid that if they had success running the ball, he might have to run it a second time or something. Harbaugh, of course, atavistic almost as a coach, like he's as retro as it can get in this era without becoming like a joke, you know, an uncompetitive joke. But Harbaugh seems to me like he still knows how to win. He just has his own idea of how to do it, even if it's not fashionable nowadays. And it's not going to be
you know, 45 pass attempts every single week, like it was with Brandon Staley, Justin Herbert. Justin Herbert instead is going to throw the ball like 35 times, with more of those pass attempts being in play action setups than they were under Staley. And more of those passes are going to go far downfield than they were under the Staley look. But we are not going to see the spread formation nonsense that the Chargers were doing every single play, no matter what. You know, it's like they're up by seven, that there's 8 minutes left in the third quarter. They're going spread. They're throwing the ball. You know, it's like they always were doing that. It's a significant part of how they managed to fail so badly under Staley. And it's also a major part of why Harbaugh is going to turn it around. But for fantasy purposes, there's not going to be quite as much to mine there. I think Herbert's going to have quality numbers. I think they're going to score points. They're going to win games. But they are not going to pursue pass attempts for the sake of pursuing pass attempts. They're not trying to game the EPA formula by just driving up the pass attempt count as high as they can, which is a lot of people to see it that way. A lot of people are trying to do that. That's what Brian Johnson was doing with the Eagles. They think that if EPA goes up, points go up, and that's not how it works, because EPA will always go up if you just throw the ball, no matter what happens. And you got to do more than that.
So as it stands, Herbert's market over on Underdog is sitting at QB 12. That is one behind Brock Purdy at QB 11. Here's kind of an interesting trio, because I'm interested in each of these three at their respective price points, anywhere between 105 and picks 116 for QBs 12 through 14. That's Justin Herbert, Tua Tagovailoa, and Trevor Lawrence, all three of those guys. Who do you envision yourself having the most exposure to of that trio?
I'm sorry, is this best ball?
This is Underdogs, yes.
Okay. I like Tua the most of that group, but that's largely just because Tua is the one of that group that, if only because of who his play caller is and who his receivers are, Tua is the one who can have a 400-yard, you know, four touchdown game, or at least I think he's the one best prepared to have that kind of game. Whereas Lawrence, it's not happening with Press Taylor. Until Press Taylor and Doug Peterson and Trent Baalke are all sent back to whatever circus they came from, like, it's just not going to get better for the Jaguars. And for Herbert, it's closer. Herbert and Tua are closer for me, but at the very least, I got to see the Chargers add a receiver, you know, ideally more than one, but they can pull off this rebuild if they keep rebuilding. You know, if they have a plan and they've got something lined up, I pretty much trust Harbaugh to do it. But if they are under the delusion that, like, oh, this Palmer and Johnson is good enough, this will work, that's enough to scare me off Herbert at that price, I guess.
Yeah, we can't go into the year, even with a depressed passing volume relative to recent years, to where it's like you feel great about 600 some odd pass attempts to, you know, with what, like 50% of them heading towards Josh Palmer or Quentin Johnston. Like, that's not going to work.
It's not going to. And you can't have like Darius Davis and Stone Smart and these other jokers on the field. Like, you can't not allow that, or at least if you do allow it, you have to assume it's going to be a rough year.
Yeah. Davis at least is like fast enough to maybe like scare some people off.
You do an end around or something,
that kind of stuff. But you know, I think generally I'm going to side with you here and remain optimistic that, you know, they can ultimately make this work. Right now that they still definitely have some work to do. I don't hate the offensive line, frankly. I mean, Rashawn, going left to right, Rashawn Slater, Zion Johnson, Corey Linsley, Jamari Sawyer, like that's solid right there. Trade Pippins.
I think they might trade back from their pick in the first round, six or whatever, five, and take probably not Alt. I think he's going to go to the Titans, but I think Latham, however you say it, that is a Harbaugh pick. That is that's an Anthony Davis out of Rutgers kind of pick for Harbaugh. And Latham to the Chargers, I think makes a ton of sense in a trade down.
Yeah, upon this rock, you know, he will build around him. That would be a nice pick, and you know, kind of underline the idea of them just getting back to playing a little more bully ball. And you know, I think our just kind of general premise being that, you know, with the entire league seemingly going in this one direction, Harbaugh could be the guy that effectively pulls off, like,
he will break the too high scourge, just as Chip Kelly would have You deal with the too high problem by what? Making them make it one high again, and then you break them over the top. But yeah, all these consultants, all these analytics interests, all these Staley types are going around saying, no, that's not how EPA get higher up. You got to make EPA go high up. And, you know, Harbaugh is just kind of he watches those people talk and say those pitches, and he just is thinking about something else the whole time. And that's why he's going to win.
Yeah, he just has his garage sale and sips his milk knowingly that he's got it figured out. All right, we're going to get into some late round draft prospects. But before that, get an exciting message from our new sponsors over at On Demand DFS. Do you ever think back to the golden days of fantasy football? You know, when it was all about the love of the game, the camaraderie, and yes, the bragging rights? Well, our friends at On Demand DFS are bringing those days back with their revolutionary app that's changing the game for fantasy fans everywhere. Gone are the days of confusing entry fees, playing against unknown masses, or juggling multiple apps to trash talk your league mates. On Demand DFS, we're here to streamline your fantasy football experience, making it more about strategy, fun, and most importantly, the community. With On Demand DFS, you can create a contest in seconds, invite your friends, and you're off to the races. No entry fees, no gimmicks, just pure fantasy football bliss. And here's the kicker. You're not limited to current season players. Imagine crafting your dream lineup from over 5,000 NFL legends and today's stars using real historical data to simulate the action. And for those who hate the wait, you'll love Turbo Mode. Contests wrap up in minutes, not hours, keeping the excitement going all week long. Download the On Demand DFS app now and get started with a 30-day trial. Dive into a fantasy football experience that's rich in history, strategy, and most importantly, fun. It's time to create your legacy with the ultimate lineup of legends and live out your fantasy football dreams like never before. I'm going to have to see what the offerings are for like Jamal Lewis 2003, because that was before I started playing fantasy, but I'd like to have like a share of that season retroactively. I don't know if that's exactly what's going on here, but
that was a golden era. 2000, of course, Jamal Lewis was also great.
Yeah. Ran for 100 yards in the Super Bowl, 34-7.
Priest Take Holmes that, Giants. Was his backup.
That's right.
Think about how good you have to be for Priest Holmes to be your backup. Ricky Williams or Jamal Lewis. That's it.
Yeah, PFG, pretty freaking good. All right, on to some late round rookies. So just to kind of like set the parameters here, these are guys that, you know, from either our summations from mock drafts or our own personal analysis, probably not going to be drafted in the first round, let alone the second or the third round. So we're looking at later round guys, but obviously those are oftentimes guys that can be the uncovered gems that help you win your leagues. Puka Nacua, the great example, of course, from last year. Not every year is going to have a Puka Nacua, of course, but you know, that's kind of the idea here is to unearth some guys that might not be available in the first round or so of your rookie drafts, but a little bit later on as you're filling out your roster, these are the guys to keep an eye on. So I wanted to kick things off with the running back position. Obviously, we're kind of not expecting that one to be mined over too much in the first round at all. Probably get started midway through the second round. We can start to imagine someone like a Blake Corum or a Jalen Wright coming off the board. But starting at running back here, Audric Estime. We've talked about him a decent bit. You know, it was not the best combine showing from him, at least in the 40. The jumps were still fine. But the 40 was certainly, you know, there is a threshold, right, for running backs. And you know, we don't want to run into an Elijah Holyfield type of situation where, like, you know, a lot of the skills and stuff seem to, you know, be on the level, but when there's just not that requisite amount of speed, it all kind of goes out the window. But according to the numbers from the Notre Dame Pro Day, this is from Ryan Roberts at Rise and Draft over on Twitter. Audric Estime was clocked at between a 4.56 and a 4.59 in the 40 at the Pro Day. So again, you always take the Pro Day numbers with a grain of salt, probably adjust back just a little bit. But you know, if all the numbers were the same in Indy and that 40 is in like the mid 4.6s, is there something here?
Yeah. Sorry. That's Dulce.
Well, Dulce was making a brief cameo.
Sorry. She loves late round running backs. So SMA running the 4.7 was pretty disappointing in large part just because he was kind of my favorite aesthetic of the 220 plus running backs. You watch him play, it looks a lot like James Conner, something like that. And including the part that for a big back, he has sort of like the balance and the coordination to make jukes, do start stop maneuvers that most guys his size can't do. So I wanted Estime to kind of be the guy at running back. Also, he has really good pass catching looks at Notre Dame. So there's, if he has the speed to be a starter viable in the NFL, then he would also have the speed, therefore, to be a three down player, including for catching passes. So he could have been a really big fantasy impact, in other words. And the 4.7 didn't make it impossible for him to do that, but he shed a little weight. Like he probably shed about like 10 pounds, maybe even more, from his playing weight for the combine, and he still ran the 4.7. So that was disappointing, and it was one of those things, like, other than LeGarrette Blount, there's just no real exception case of this working out at the NFL level. There's occasionally cases like that. Blount is, he ran like a 4.7 something, I don't know, coming out of Oregon. And even his rookie year, he had a really big season, albeit as an undrafted rookie. So it just narrows SMA's path quite a bit if he's a 4.7 guy. But like you said, his jumps were very good, and not good for a big running back, big by any standard of running backs, you know, 87th percentile, according to mock draftable for the vertical, for the broad jump, 88th percentile. So if you're a 63rd percentile running back in terms of weight and you have 88th percentile jumps, you're not just some slug, even if you are running a 4.7. And he also, I didn't notice this before, I wish I had, his 10-yard split at the combine was fine. In fact, it was slightly above average itself. So Estime is probably closer to a 4.7 40 guy than he is a 4.58 or whatever he's getting from these Notre Dame times. It's probably about the same time, but I don't want to rule out the third round. I think the fourth round is more likely where Estime goes, but more importantly, wherever he goes, I think his profile is just close enough to viable. You know, it's like if a 4.65 isn't great, that's, for instance, what, you know, Samaje Perine ran at 20 more pounds, moreover. But I do think it's safe. Maybe I'm just trying to be overly optimistic or something, but I think Estime is unique for the category just because of, again, of how the moves he makes, the kind of coordination that he has. It allows him to play big running back when it's useful and small running back when big running back is a liability, you know, and throwing the pass catching. I think he's got a good shot. It's hard to know with a player like him what kind of opportunity he's going to get from the NFL. And of course, opportunity is the initial, you know, primary driver of fantasy utility. So if Estime does go in the third round or something, in other words, high enough in the draft for a team to commit to him and give him a serious shot, then I like his chances. If he ends up in more of like a running back three on some team, then I worry about him getting that initial chance to get his foot in the door. But right. SMA was super productive at Notre Dame, including as a big play runner. So he's got something to work with. He's not a bum. He's not going to go like to the practice squad, I don't think.
Keeping it Notre Dame for a set, it'd be funny and also kind of a smart pick by the Rams if they got Estime, you know, to spell Kyren Williams, like a, you know,
they should get somebody. It's just the weird thing for them is McVay seems to have this weird obsession with only playing one running back in a game. He hates taking a running back out of the game, even if they're 5'9", 190 pounds, and are clearly going to get hurt if he keeps doing this. But it aesthetic, if they're looking for any amount of balance, Estime is, you know, he's a classic, you know, Thunder case. If someone has a limited Lightning runner, then Estime is a good way to kind of create a full assortment of skill set there.
So I will continue to think that Estime is a fine enough, you know, late round dart in best ball until we, you know, as we keep drafting for this next month or so, and until we figure out his final landing spot. You know, I think that there's a chance it ends up being favorable and that draft price ends up going up. So I'm going to maintain my optimism for Estime. Not overreacting too much to the pro day stuff, but just kind of generally speaking, I think he is someone to keep on the radar. Another day three guy that is of some interest. We've talked about him a little bit, but Dylan Johnson out of Washington by way of Mississippi State was a super effective pass catcher during his time at Miss State, was effective on a per target basis that this past year at Washington, just wasn't asked to do it a cartoonish amount. Just caught like 24 out of 26 targets this past year for the Huskies, who of course made it all the way to the national championship game. Checks in 6 foot, 217. Combine numbers a bit disconcerting to say the least, but I don't know. I feel like this guy can play football, but you know, I think it's something to where we're probably not going to hear his name called until at least like halfway through the Saturday portion of the draft.
Yeah, I don't expect Johnson to necessarily get drafted, but he's, I think, fantasy viable, and especially in dynasty leagues, you're going to want to keep an eye on Dylan Johnson. And you know, fourth, fifth round range of your dynasty drafts, I can't imagine a much better running back pick than him, because he, while Dylan Johnson has, you know, below average athleticism, clearly below average athleticism, and it's even if you adjust for size, it's still below average. It gets a little better when you adjust for size, and in fact, you know, Johnson's main asset might be his volume capacity. You know, he's got the ability to take a lot of reps and hold up with it, both as a runner and as a pass catcher. He's got so many reps in passing downs. Not that I know a whole lot about pass blocking, I feel safe in assuming he's one of the more fluent blitz pickup guys in the draft after having done it so many times, and he has the frame to do it. But the athleticism is, of course, below average, and specifically the explosiveness, the speed is below average. What I think he has just enough of is the kind of functional athleticism that doesn't show up in athletic testing. It's the stuff like breaking down in traffic between the tackles and being able to anchor quickly reorient himself, change direction, start moving again. It's like he's seamless with that kind of stuff. The procedural aspects of running the ball, he's natural at it. He's just not fast at it. And but the ability to go from anchor to change direction to burst, that kind of stuff he's good at. And that's to me a player who's got a certain amount of like functional smoothness to them. Like he's not going to run away from anybody, but if a running back, for instance, needs to, you know, shed a linebacker at the line of scrimmage and then change direction and bounce outside because that linebacker blew his gap to try to make that tackle attempt, Johnson is able to shed that first guy and keep moving without needing to stop and gather himself, without needing a lot of help. He can kind of grind out that tough yardage in between the tackles. And if he can do the passing down stuff, then I think in a way Dylan Johnson becomes what a lot of people thought Roschon Johnson would be. And by that, I mean, he can stay on the field through whatever play call it is. And yeah, he's not explosive. He's not going to give you big plays, but if for some reason you are content with a running back who just gets what's there as a runner and doesn't drop the ball and breaks arm tackles, does like, you know, 50 grade type stuff, Johnson, I think, can do that. And if there's a specific example that I have in mind of the way it can work out for him, if only for a short amount of time, like, you remember Daryl Williams with the Chiefs, right? He was like a fullback tweener out of LSU. He was the passing down guy when they had Darius Geis, ran a 4.7 of hits, and he had passing down fluency to kind of just get his foot in the door with the Chiefs. And for a while there, a lot of people were convinced that Daryl Williams was a really good, like, starting NFL running back just because of how favorable it is to play in the Pat Mahomes offense. But I think if Dylan Johnson were to end up in a situation like that, he would do at least as good, and or better. And I was trying to think of somebody he might kind of emulate, but admittedly it has been a long time since there was a 4-7 guy who really worked out for more than a couple games at a time. It's like the Darrell Williams case might be the best case, but I don't know. Dylan Johnson produced in two different kinds of offenses and in two different kinds of roles. And you know, he doesn't go down easy. He's got the anchor ability, catches everything. I think he's got a shot. The undrafted types, he's got to be one of the best, I think.
I think so too. I really thought that he was one of the most impactful transfers in all of college football last year, because they obviously had the passing game working like it was known. You know, Penix did well his first year there, but adding in a running back like Dylan Johnson, like, really made them a more complete offense. And, you know, the second that you drop everyone back, you know, you're getting, you know, 7 yards of Dylan Johnson, and you know, the things would keep moving. So very shrewd pickup from Washington. And I do hope that he has a shot, because I think he can capitalize on the opportunity.
The skill level is high.
Yes.
The tools are low grade, but the skill level is high.
And we can respect some skill. Outside of these two, not to put you on the spot too much, but this is a smaller school guy. One that fell out of your purview when we were talking combine last month. We talked a little bit about Jaden Sheridan and Dylan Lobb, but the other FCS guy that was at the combine, Isaiah Davis out of South Dakota State, 6 foot 218, ran the 4.57. Not particularly good on the jumps, but you know, someone that was a big producer during his time with the Jackrabbits. I think won some sort of award at the FCS level this past year. Co-offensive player of the year, in fact, and two-time first team all Missouri Valley Football Conference award winner. So any thoughts on him? Do you think he has a shot to get drafted? And if so, do we need to keep him on the radar?
So it's usually tough for these whatever Dakota State type running backs to get a serious look at the NFL. There's been a lot of good ones to come out of those schools, you know, players who produced really well for North Dakota State and South Dakota State. I'm thinking of the Zach Zenners, and there was that like John Crockett or whoever, and these guys who actually tested surprisingly well in addition to running for really big numbers in college. So Isaiah Davis being like the next in line of this type, it's tough to be decisively optimistic, in my opinion. He's more the category of running back who, if he's in the right place at the right time, might get some opportunity and might surprise people with how well he does with it, and from that situation kind of keep his traction in that offense going forward. And in the event that Davis does get his foot in the door, like you said, 6 foot 218, ran for big numbers at South Dakota State. When you watch Isaiah Davis play, he has a distinctly, you know, rugged style of play. He's kind of almost a bully kind of mentality. Like, he seems to kind of headbutt people and stuff. And you can kind of imagine him being kind of just tough to bring down. I mean, he certainly was at South Dakota State. So much like Dylan Johnson, I think Isaiah Davis is one of those guys. I do rank Isaiah Davis a little bit better. His testing is not great, like you said, but it's definitely a magnitude at least better than the Dylan Johnson types. So it's one of those things, like, if you knew a team was going to commit to him, it'd be easy to kind of get excited. But in the meantime, if Isaiah Davis were to go undrafted or something, then there's also a pretty good chance we're just looking at the next Alex Barnes case or something like that.
Oh man, I remember being an Alex Barnes head, because I think he like broke the combine record for bench press among running backs or something. And I was like, that must mean he's good, and he's about to take carries off of Derrick Henry's plate.
He had good testing too, so yeah, his testing is just hard to call. But Isaiah Davis, yeah, he's totally in that Dylan Johnson category where it's like, hey, if he gets a shot, there's no guarantee that it's going to go well or anything, but we also can't cross him out. Like, there's some guys that I think we can cross out, and Davis, Johnson, they are not that type.
I don't think so either. And then one guy that maybe our optimism slipping on a little bit. What's your latest thought on Braylon Allen?
Well, he's always been a tough one for me anyway, because as much as he has an entertaining tape and as much as Braylon Allen has really good numbers, certainly at Wisconsin, including numbers that I don't believe that's ever happened aside from Jamal Williams with BYU. Allen was 17 years old his first year at Wisconsin, and you know, like 17 and 3/4 or whatever. But that's pretty crazy to put up big numbers like he did to start at all at that age at a school like Wisconsin. That's definitely a big accomplishment. However, Wisconsin, more than most schools, has a long history of running backs who were great college running backs and didn't do anything in the NFL. It might be the premier school for this category of player. You're going all the way back to, you know, basically since Ron Dane, this has been a recurring theme. And
it's littered with John Clays of the world.
John Clay is the exact perfect example for people who are shrugging off Braylon Allen's 40 times concerns, because you'll see that there's this thing on, you know, Twitter. You'll find any high for any player, and there's a Braylon Allen high forming. And they're just kind of like, look, if you think that he's too slow, if you think he can't run a good 40, then just watch this. Watch him run away from Illinois State for a long touchdown. And you got to understand, those plays don't mean anything. Moreover, you have to understand, there have been players like this. There have been players like Braylon Allen for Wisconsin, and just better. John Clay is one of them. John Clay, he added a bunch of weight over his career and got slower over the course of it. Granted, like he was legitimately toolsy, I think, at one point. But he ran a 4.8 after putting up much better numbers at Wisconsin than Braylon, or not much better, but safely better numbers at Wisconsin. I think anybody who knows Wisconsin football would tell you that certainly John Clay was better than Braylon Allen. And as far as Braylon Allen's category goes with Wisconsin, it's probably more along the PJ Hill kind of lines than it is even the John Clay ones. So when you have this context for a player like Braylon Allen, who again otherwise put up big numbers, there's a certain burden of proof that falls on the player to demonstrate how they're going to be different from these other running back cases who just burned out once they left Wisconsin, you know,
right.
And not running the 40 yard dash at the Wisconsin Pro Day, which Braylon Allen declined to do that. He didn't want to run the 40, said that he didn't have enough time to train from an ankle injury, and fair enough to have a delayed workout or whatever, but he was doing the jumps at the combine, you know. I think your ankle isn't that bad if you're training for jumps at the combine, doing jumps at the combine. And moreover, he could reschedule the workout if he wanted to. If Wisconsin mm-hmm. would accommodate him, I know that they would. They would say, like, yeah, come back to the McLean Center in early April. You can run your 40 then. Well, the athletic department will set up this special thing. We'll do a press release and all that. And he could run his 40 then, get another, you know, 3 weeks of training or whatever. And on that track, the Wisconsin track, their pro day track, it would be almost difficult to run any slower than like a 4.65. If you mm-hmm. run a 4.7 in the combine, you're running a 4.58 at worst on the Wisconsin track. So for him to decline that cushy setup for running the 40, maybe it's just poor judgment on him, on his part and his agent's part. Maybe he really can run like a 4.55 or something. But if he can, it's insane to not do it. Completely insane. And so I'm forced to conclude he doesn't run a 4.55. He runs a 4.8 or a 4.85. And that's completely well precedented too. Like I mentioned on Twitter, it's like Elijah Holyfield, David Cobb. There are running backs who have run 4.8s in the past. And when you watch them play in college, when you look at the numbers they accumulate in college, you would sooner assume, oh, these guys make a bunch of big plays. You know, they got a bunch of touchdowns. They got high yards per carry, all that. They were running a 4.8, you know? And if Allen is another one of those guys, it won't be a big story. It's like those kinds of players happen pretty regularly, actually.
David Cobb, my first paid assignment at RotoWire was covering the Big Ten, and I was a big David Cobb guy. Who else? Tevin Coleman. Those were the two. Tevin. And then, of course, Mikey Dudek. What could have been?
that actually is a bummer. Yeah,
it is. Let's see. Any other late round running backs that catch your eye before we move on over to receiver?
I want to mention real quickly, I don't know if people consider him a day two or a late round guy. I don't know where he's going to go, but Marshawn Lloyd with USC, previously South Carolina. I think the deal with him is pretty simple. Like in terms of the anchor, change of direction, burst, speed, density of build, Marshawn Lloyd does grade uniquely well, but he's also the worst fumbler we've seen since at least Sony Michel, and maybe worse than him and anybody a long time before that too. So if that can be corrected, sometimes guys correct it. Like I guess Tiki Barber kind of corrected it. Jonathan Taylor has mostly corrected it. If Lloyd can correct it, then he can play. I just don't know if he can correct it, because you know he got to USC and they're like, look, we saw you fumble at South Carolina, so stop doing that. Hold the ball like this, etc. Kept fumbling anyway. So I don't know what his problem is. Otherwise, I probably am guilty of overlooking Ray Davis a little too quickly, the Kentucky / Vanderbilt / Temple running back. Mm-hmm. 5'8", 211, like Kimani Vidal of Troy, 5'8", but very dense, you know, they, and Corum even, Corum's not as dense as the other two, but it's like, you can be 5'8" and still hold up as a lead runner. Being over 210 certainly helps. And his test, Ray Davis is testing, 4.5 140. That's good enough. He's definitely one of those, also caught a lot of passes at Kentucky this last year. So there's reason to believe Ray Davis has a three down skill set. One of those guys, again, who, if he gets his foot in the door, it's not obvious why he would go back to the bench. What's less obvious is, again, figuring out how he's going to get on the field in the first place. But three down profile, volume potential. Ray Davis is another one of those guys who has a big time, I think, dynasty upside, despite a pretty modest profile.
If I can give like a little bit of a viewer's guide to Ray Davis, cut on his game against Florida this year. Sit back and enjoy. It's like 10 yards a carry for like 25 carries.
Yeah, those are games like that, you know, help point separate the merely good by college standards versus the types that can kind of have a little extra at the next level.
Yeah, I mean, it's not Illinois State, but it's not that much better than Illinois State. I mean to say, Billy has run Florida into the ground, but you know, even still,
4.5. I mean, Davis could run a little bit. I mean, 4.5 is not terribly slow, you know. So it's Braylon Allen in his 4.85 can outrun Illinois State, whereas Davis in his 4.51 can outrun mid tier SEC defenses.
That's right. The Chad Ray Davis.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
All right, on to some receivers. I feel like we haven't talked a ton about Jermaine Burton. Frankly, he's a bit of a sore subject for me. former Bulldog, links up with Alabama after winning a national championship at Georgia, goes to Bama. Kind of just his usage never really like spiked, I think, the way that a lot of people expected. A career high of 63 targets in his first year with the Tide in 2022. I think a lot of people expected him to use that transfer as a springboard
especially linking up with Bryce Young in his final year to be in the NFL, you know, this past year when he would have been eligible to. But he comes back for his senior year, 13.8 yards per target. Low volume again, just 58 targets this past year, but 13.8 yards per target, 8 touchdowns, 39 catches on that sample. So, I mean, like the efficiency has always been pretty crazy as far as Burton's concerned. I mean, each of his last 3 years, well over 10 yards per target, including two of those seasons being over 13.5 yards per target. So that's always been there for him. I think he has, you know, the requisite size and everything to you know, be an NFL player, 6'1", 196, runs the 4.45, had the good broad jump, 133-inch broad jump. So, I mean, there's some athletic tools to go with the you know, impressive on a sample basis production in college.
Yeah, I think actually Burton will go more around day two than day three. I think at the second or third round he'll go. That crazy Georgia recruiting era of receivers, they had Burton, Ladd McConkey, and Aiden I. Mitchell at the same time. Some other guys that John would know that I've forgotten.
Marcus Roseme.
Yeah, so really crowded group, and Burton still played as a true freshman. He's something like 6 months older than McConkey, so this might have played a role in it, but McConkey actually redshirted the first year that he and Burton were at Georgia, and Burton played that first year along with, I believe, Mitchell? Or Mitchell was, I don't know if Mitchell was the second. Anyway, that's not to say that Burton is better than McConkey. I don't see it that way, but he might have been better at the time.
He was a much bigger recruit.
He might have been better at the time. And Burton also, he's one of those guys that is easy to fit into an offense, even as a like rotational type, because he's a big play receiver. He's really good, you know, downfield, making big plays. So he can play, you know, 30 snaps, give you 5 targets, draw much more air yardage per snap than the guy who's playing 60 snaps and has like an 8 yard depth of target. The question for Burton, I think, is can he do more than that? Can he be more than like a decoy slash big play wide receiver two, wide receiver three type? And it's fine if he's more the latter. And I feel safe saying with Burton, that's his floor. Like the absolute worst case scenario for Burton is he's like a wide receiver four that we get our hopes up for every, you know, couple months because he makes a huge play and then disappears. Like that's the worst case scenario for him. He might be a decent starter. He might be more than that. And I think, you know, back to the floor point, like we know he has to be some level of good because he's already held serve against all these other guys that we're talking about in the first round, let alone the second or the third. So I think he will go in the second or the third. I don't see the underneath game quite as much with Burton as we do with McConkey. The tools aren't quite as outrageously loud as in the case of Mitchell. So Burton kind of, there will be a team taking him. It admittedly isn't obvious to see, you know, where he's going to go and what vision everybody has in mind with him. But for what it's worth, I've had to make fun of certainly the running back comparisons that you see in NFL.com, Lance Zierlein's player comps at running back are just like total bizarro world, like crazy person stuff. His comparison for Burton, I think, was right on the mark, though. He compared him to Kenny Stills. And Burton won't get as much flack from the NFL and coaches and front offices for counter-cultural tendencies. So he'll probably go way higher than Stills did in the fifth round. But, you know, the theme being wide receiver two type who generally doesn't go over the middle that much is that makes his best plays downfield, makes plays downfield much better than most receivers. And, you know, hopefully he ends up with a good quarterback so he can, you know, fully unleash his downfield game. Cause a guy like Burton, if he has Kenny Pickett at quarterback, I don't know if he's doing anything, you know.
Burton's freshman year, he set at least the Georgia freshman single game record, and it might have been Georgia's overall single game record against Miss State, which was JT Daniels's first start for the Dogs.
They also would have had Forbes, I think, at the time.
Yeah, and did not seem to matter. Anytime that Daniels lofted that sucker up, Burton was coming down with it for a big play. That was a fun Saturday night. But beyond him, I think you do make an interesting point that he might slip into the top 100 and therefore not be a day three guy. Beyond him, you know, Roman Wilson gets a lot of buzz. Obviously, I've been guilty of it. I don't feel guilty about it, but I've definitely pounded the table for him. But his teammate Cornelius Johnson, is there anything that kind of stands out to you with him? 6'3", 208, runs the low 4.4. You know, production obviously not amazing. Again, the Michigan passing offense, you got to kind of take it through with a fine-tooth comb to really take out some meaning from it. But like, is Cornelius Johnson like a good like discount like Roman Wilson in your opinion? I know the games are different, but you know, as far as fantasy capital.
Wilson's going to go higher, it seems like, but I wonder if it's possible where, you know, the general draft media scene, maybe we're overlooking Cornelius Johnson just a little bit, especially if all the Roman Wilson heads are correct to be high on him, which I'm in the middle on that, I guess. Like I can see some ways it could work for him, but I am a little unnerved by how there's some of the biggest Roman Wilson fans just assure you, you know, like he's a crazy burner, singular speed. You know, the safeties are always afraid of him. I don't know if I really see that. I see probably like at least a 50 grade player and one who does the valuable function of keeping the safeties back. But you know, Cornelius Johnson produced earlier at Michigan than Wilson did. Granted, Wilson completely took over the offense this last year, you know, getting like whatever, like 38% of their passing production or something like that. So Johnson had the lead in previous years, lost it this year. But if Wilson is as good as, you know, his biggest fans say, then there is room for Roman Wilson to be an above average starting NFL receiver and for Johnson to maybe be the same, otherwise at least an average starter. It's hard to be a useless player when you're 6'3", 212 and have, you know, 4.4 speed, really good jumps. And again, the production was totally decent at Michigan. It was efficient. The volume was what wasn't there. So for that reason, Johnson profiles as like a wide receiver 2 or 3 type only, but I feel the same thing is true of Wilson. So Wilson doesn't require as much speculation and he's going to get picked high enough that, you know, he'll get the NFL opportunity. But yeah, Johnson's just a mid-round type or no. Players as athletic as him who produced to the level as he did don't disappear. Like, almost never happens, you know?
Right. So I think he's definitely someone to keep an eye on. You know, admittedly, I've fallen for Michigan receivers in the past. Donovan Peoples-Jones, Jehu Chesson, Amara Darbo.
Amara Darbo, yeah. I will say that what's a little bit distinguished from the Darbo and the Chesson cases is, again, back when Ronnie Bell was still the lead Michigan receiver, Johnson was kind of like matching him, like holding serve against Bell, while Wilson was kind of the wide receiver 3 at the time. So Darbo and I think Chesson too, they didn't do anything until they were like 21, 22 years old at Michigan. So if Johnson producing earlier than that is an indication of a skill set, then whereas in the case of Chesson and especially Darbo, they had only tools and no skill, Johnson definitely has the tools and I think there's reason to believe he has more skill than either of those guys.
Okay. All right. So some lingering optimism, you know, kind of see where he lands, but, you know, definitely a name to circle going into the upcoming draft. Where else
the Washington duo? Yeah, the Washington duo of Jalen McMillan and Jalen Polk, I feel like, is pretty tough to call. The answer might be that they're both good. I mean, what happened basically with them is Polk transferred to Washington from Texas Tech, where he played a little bit, did pretty good as a true freshman. And Jalen McMillan, meanwhile, was already at Washington and doing quite well. I think it was as a sophomore, McMillan led the Washington passing game and all receiving stats. It was a down year for the team. He had like 400 yards or something. But even after Romo Dunze took over, establishing himself as, I think, a blue chip wide receiver 1 type, McMillan in 2022 was really close to Odunze's production level. He wasn't quite there, and defenses cared a lot more about Odunze. So it was within the context of wide receiver 2 level of attention that he was producing, that McMillan was producing that way. But he did. He took you know, totally good, like a fifth plus share of the targets of the Washington offense was way above the team baseline, even though they had Odunze, you know, really propelling the baseline upward too. So McMillan played really well. Then in 2023, McMillan got hurt early in the year, and then Polk went nuts. So we've seen both McMillan and Polk go nuts in that wide receiver two role for Washington State. Maybe the answer is they're both, you know, wide receiver two, wide receiver three types in the NFL as well. But as far as calling which one would be better, it's really difficult to me. And I think you might say like Polk is distinguished from McMillan in that Polk is more of the jump ball type, maybe more of a leaping presence, whereas McMillan I think has more of the horizontal kind of game, more fits more easily into you know, running drag routes and stuff like that. So they might both be good. It's just one of those things. In the meantime, you see projections for them to be drafted anywhere from like the third round to the fifth or the sixth in either case. It's tough to know sometimes, but you know, they if both of these guys, McMillan and Polk, were to go in like the third round of the draft, I don't think you should find it surprising. And if they do, their dynasty stock is going to go, you know, way higher. Cause right now they're in that like no man's land where no one really wants to take them an underdog because they're worried about taking a zero. But if they go in the third round, then everyone's going to be taking them as high as like the, you know, 15th or something like that. So those two are interesting to watch. And otherwise, I'm not really in on Brendan Rice. I think he's kind of just a rotational guy. Same with Javon Baker. Don't like them. But Luke McCaffrey, I have some hope for. And I think, Max McCaffrey, the Duke receiver, mm-hmm. he was the first one between him, Christian, and of course now Luke. But if Christian had broke out before Max came out of Duke, maybe Max would have gotten a longer look. And maybe Luke, being a former like four-star Nebraska quarterback recruit, maybe he'll get a longer look for that reason too. So really productive with Rice this last year. Maybe the latest McCaffrey can make a pretty good run at it.
I feel like I've known about Luke McCaffrey for eons, and his career has taken on so many different forms. Like he was such a big deal as a high school quarterback that I think ESPN showed a Colorado like high school football game featuring him, and ends up as a Rice receiver. But at the same time, tested really well. So I think that you know, there's some definite reason to be interested there. I mean, the 4 second shuttle and the 6.7 in the cone drill, you know, those are definitely interesting numbers. I'm kind of with you on Brendan Rice. And when it comes to Javon Baker, I'm willing to hold out some optimism, but I think I also know the market at this point, like the Baker hive is fully matured. Like it's going to be there. It's going to be above where I'm willing to spend on Baker. So therefore I'm probably just not going to get a ton of him. One more to throw out your way. Have you looked at Bub Means at all?
I meant to that. Yeah. He's a really weird case. So correct me if I'm wrong. He was originally a corner recruit at Tennessee, right? And then he transferred to Louisiana Tech back when they had I can't remember. They had a bunch of guys, and he kind of was like low on the depth chart, even as a second or third year player or whatever he would have been at the time. But then he was explosive that 1 year and transferred to Pittsburgh after that, got a little more playing time. So I was trying to pull up that Louisiana Tech route, because sometimes you get those weird cases like Rashee Rice where a guy is known and seems to be taken somewhat seriously as a receiver for some mid-major team, but everyone kind of also just quickly put, you know, shoes away the possibility that he goes very high. But as we saw with Rice, even though he was buried by all these veteran receivers like Roberson and whatever else SMU
James
had,
Prochet,
all those guys were kind of blocking him. But he had, in the end, you know, a totally good excuse. And as it turned out, he was a real NFL plus starter the whole time, despite kind of being buried on that initial depth chart. But in any case, Memes is a size speed guy and a little short on production. Got a little more production at Pittsburgh, of course. It's just kind of, as a fifth year player, the numbers that Bub Memes posted for Pittsburgh in 2023, they don't really move the needle for me. They sort of are, it's the kind of numbers I see that I need to see to not cross you off It's not really enough for me to take leaps of faith or anything like that. But what can help you get over, you know, skepticism about memes is the way he tested at the combine. So the 4.43 40, 39.5 vertical, big wingspan, at 6'1", 212. So I don't have any insight on how memes tested in like the gauntlet drill or anything like that that he might have done. But if teams look at Bub memes and you know they look at the tools, it's demonstrated pretty easily. If they see, for whatever reason, a developmental track for him, if they see a way that he can harness those tools more in the NFL level, then he could crash day two at some point. I'd be a little surprised by that. To me, Bub memes is more like a fifth, sixth round type. But honestly, I do like him more than Javon Baker, because at least with memes, you have the obviously, you know, demonstrated plus tools that I can more easily project some sort of growth as a player. If you're an average athlete with average production, it's just kind of like you're just a long, long shot now.
Right. So in Means's case, you know, you bring up the 2021 Louisiana Tech Bulldogs, and of course, who could forget? But there is a bit of explanation as to why Means wasn't producing at a super high level until he went to Pitt. Not that he ever produced at like a crazy level or anything, but Trey Harris is going to be someone that we talk about a lot this time.
Oh, nice.
Next year. For he transferred to Ole Miss and crushed this past year, and I believe he'll be back for this coming season. Had 54 catches for almost 1,000 yards and 8 touchdowns at Ole Miss this past year. So I think that can give Means a slight pass as far as you know, not doing much in his first year at receiver at Louisiana Tech. And Smoke Harris was a huge part of that Louisiana Tech offense back then as well. Let's round it out. Any quarterbacks here in this year's class that, you know, Purdy is clearly like a once every 15, 20 years type of case where he, you know, he falls that far in the draft and ends up, you know, making something of himself as a every week starter. But anyone that you know falls outside of that, Caleb, Drake May, Jaden Daniels, JJ McCarthy, Michael Penix, Bo Nix, cluster that we expect to all be gone by maybe the end of the first round, if not the top 40 picks. Anyone else that might be worth taking a shot on, like a super flex dynasty?
I don't really see it. Maybe that Tulane Michael Pratt sticks around. I don't really know. Joe Milton is, I guess, the name that comes to mind after Nix, after Penix. But Joe Milton is a really weird case. It could go a few ways. I don't think it's going to be like he goes in the second round, but Milton could go in the late third, especially if some team has a comp pick, you know, pick, what would it be, like 100 or later or something like that. Mm-hmm. They might take Milton just because he can throw the ball, you know, like a mile, and he probably runs no worse than a 4.7 or something like that. So I don't think he can play, but as far as like stunt throws and stuff like that go, hard to deny that Milton can do stuff like that better than anybody. And if there is some way to develop him at all and harness it at all, which some team will probably convince themselves they can,
right?
In theory, he would just go nuts. I just think it's also pretty clear the case that some guys who have really strong throwing arms can't play quarterback, and at an NFL level anyway. And I figure he's probably in that group.
Yeah. Like I saw some people being like, well, if we all fell in love with Anthony Richardson, why can't we fall in love with Joe Milton? It's like, well, Richardson a lot younger, you know, shorter starting experience, obviously, but you know, like I think that he's the more like worthwhile risk, and the NFL obviously agreed with him being a top five pick, and Milton not going to sniff that by any means. And it's because, you know, Milton had shots like over his time in college.
Michigan never, yeah.
Yep. Yep. So, yeah. You know, so like, who's he getting beat out at Michigan by, like Cade McNamara? And then, you know, Hennon, not to besmirch Cade too much, but you know, you also have him go to Tennessee and probably expecting to be the guy. And then Hennon Hooker beats him out. So, I mean, if you like created a player on Madden, like he might look like Joe Milton, but I just don't really think he ever puts it together.
Back in the Ray Lewis, the 2004 Madden, when they had the training camp mode and franchise mode where you could just throw through the rings and then add to their throwing accuracy and stuff, Joe Milton would be awesome in franchise mode with that drill, because you could just get his awareness up, you know, 20 points over 3 years, and he just goes from like 63 overall to 90 or something. Because the same way that happens, the thing that I just described, you know, some team is going to convince themselves like, it's, we can get him, we just got to make him throw through the silver and gold rings, and then we'll add to his THACC and his AWR, and then we'll all look like geniuses. More likely though is like he just kind of gets moved to tight end in a year or something.
Get ready to learn Tyree Jackson, right? Is that from Buffalo?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't know how he would be better than Tyree, to be totally serious.
No, I thought he was, you know, a worthwhile prospect or like project gamble at the quarterback spot, but Kasley didn't agree. Yeah. Last one I'll throw out there, Austin Reed out of Western Kentucky. Just great numbers the last 2 years. I think that he probably doesn't have the processing that Bailey Zappe did when he was at Western Kentucky, but I think he has like a little bit more of like a projectable frame at, you know, 6'2", 220. I don't know. He just had good enough numbers. I think that I'll like keep an eye on where he lands. I don't know if he ends up being great. I know the Western Kentucky offense is kind of one that doesn't always lend itself to being pro ready, but I'm at least expecting him to get drafted. And in some cases where you just need a able body to fill out your roster, I wouldn't poo-poo Austin Reed necessarily.
Hey man, Skylar Thompson got drafted. So if this guy or someone else I never heard of goes in the fifth, it's just, hey, that's the kind of world we live in now. But if it's not Reed or if it's not Pratt or Milton, it's just, I literally don't even know a fourth name. So I like a little easier to find sleepers at tight end, for instance, where we got Ben Sinnott, the Kansas State GOAT. And, you know, Case Over from Ohio State. There's Eric All from Iowa. There's some real, to be serious, those guys are in tight end premium leagues at the very least in Dynasty. And I'd say Sinnott should be on your main, Sinnott and Stover should be on the mainstream Dynasty radar as well.
I like those calls. And Eric All, he got injured last year, correct?
He's the tight end version of Jonathan Brooks kind of in this draft, because it's like we don't know what that ACL means, and he might not be available this year or whatever, but if he hadn't been hurt, we might have been talking about him in like round three or even two.
So one more sleeper tight end for you. This is a recurring theme that we've identified long ago, but Penn State guys do awesome at the combine. Doesn't always mean they're going to be awesome pros. They always do awesome at the combine. Theo Johnson, the latest example, 6'6", just under 260, runs the 4.57, had the crazy shuttle time, and also tested in the 80th percentile or better in his vertical and broad jumps. Is there a chance that he's able to unlock those tools at the next level? Is it something that you'd be willing to potentially roster?
He's kind of interesting. Yeah, I didn't mean to totally skip Theo Johnson, but he's so what distinguishes Sinnott and Stover right off the bat is those guys both were regular team leading type pass catchers, right? Whereas Theo Johnson was more he would require like a more of like a accommodated setup sort of thing. So 53 targets in 2023 was the career high for Theo Johnson. And before that, his career high was 29. Would have, in the case of 2022, if he hadn't gotten hurt, I guess he could have projected it to be closer to like 35 targets. But in any case, that 30 target range for a college tight end, especially an inline type like Theo Johnson, which he is, he's 6'6", 259, which is really, really big for a tight end. He can play in line. He can line up against, you know, defensive ends and block them, especially in the run game. When you're running from that spot, what you aren't doing is lining up in the slot and running a route against a safety or something who is specifically
trying to stop you from catching the ball. More often, a guy like Theo Johnson is kind of just blocking until they run like a leak type concept where it's like he starts blocking on a play, slips out, and the quarterback gets to his third read, and it's the safety valve target, you know, that kind of thing. So right. I could see Theo Johnson being more like a CJ Uzomah type at the NFL level. Uzomah was also quite toolsy coming out of Auburn, and might have even been a little more productive at Auburn than Theo Johnson was at Penn State. But to be fair to Johnson, he also is a more toolsy athlete than Uzomah. Like, Uzomah's quite toolsy, but Theo Johnson, you know, the 4.57 40, 125 inch broad jump, those are really high figures for any tight end, and certainly one as big as him. So it's not for an inability to run down the field. Like he's big enough, fast enough to play tight end in a pass catching capacity. It's just he hasn't shown it, in my opinion, playing at Penn State. It requires projection at the very least. And in the case of Sennett and Stover and Eric All, you just know they can play. If you need a blocker, they can probably do that. But it's specifically for pass catching, it's Sennett, Stover, and All after, you know, Brock Bowers and Jatavion Sanders.
Yes, Bowers still holding the crown, of course. I guess I don't know. I will mention Trey Knox, but I'm not convinced that there's anything there. But he was like a huge recruit when he started out at Arkansas, and kind of was a tweener. He was recruited as a wide receiver, converted to tight end. I'm at least like keeping him in my back pocket, but.
Also, especially for fantasy, that Jahiim Bell guy, because if it's not obvious to me how he'll see the field, but if he does, you know, he's not out there to block. So outside shot that he turns into like a Delanie Walker or whatever.
Yeah, he ran the ball a decent bit at South Carolina and Florida State, both kind of an interesting offensive weapon. But yeah, the size, it becomes much less obvious as to how he gets a role carved out for him. But maybe someone will be enamored enough. I could see, you know, speaking of Delanie Walker, I could see Harbaugh and Roman figuring something out with him potentially.
They won't be lining up Stone Smart, you know. They're going to get somebody better than I think they are going to add somebody after even, yeah, Disley and Hurst.
Yeah, I think they need to. That doesn't scream to me that it's that they've completely fixed the tight end problem. Too bad that Trey McKitty never really turned out to be much of anything. That's going to do it for us here on this edition of the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast. Again, big thanks to everyone that listened. Big thanks to our sponsors over at On Demand DFS. Again, if you want to get behind RotoWire's paywall, we got just a little bit more time of baseball drafting season. So if you need those last minute rankings, we've got them. We've got them behind the paywall. Try that free trial over at rotowire.com/pod. For Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thanks for listening.